Welcome to the podcast, The Caring Scientist, Mission Sustainable. This is the podcast where we discuss sustainability in science and we give you hands-on tips on how you can reduce the environmental impact of your lab work.
Welcome to the second episode of our podcast. I'm Adriana and
I'm Nicoline.
So today we want to talk about plastics in labs. And stay tuned to listen to the end, because we are going to give you practical tips on how to become a sustainable scientist. Plastics are cheap, they are lightweight, tough, waterproof, transparent. Plastics are almost a perfect material that we can find everywhere in our modern society. However, most plastics are derived from fossil fuels, and the production imposes a huge impact on the environment. And it's not only the production. Unlike organic materials in nature, conventional plastics are just simply not biodegradable. They simply break down into smaller and smaller pieces, into so-called microplastics. And this is the reason why we have a plastic waste problem in the world. Plastic stays forever on our planet. And because of the multitude of single-use plastic items in labs, research also contributes to a significant amount to the environmental pollution. So, Nicolina, how much plastic waste do scientific labs generate?
Researchers back in 2015 estimated that academic research labs produce around 5.5 million tons of plastic waste every year. And that's more or less the equivalent in weight as 67 cruise liners, these huge ships, and it's almost 2% of the entire world's plastic waste production every year. And this is, of course, just an estimate, and it's only the academic research labs. There are also all the industrial research labs and all the hospitals. So obviously, science is producing a massive amount of plastic waste. Adriana, you're still working in a lab. I left the lab around a year ago to work as an independent green lab consultant. But you're still in the lab. How do you feel about the plastic waste in your lab?
I personally feel shocked when I hear about the millions of tons of plastic that come out of scientific institutions. And as you were saying, this study is only about academic labs. Also, the question is, what actually happens to the lab plastic waste? Because as a scientist, we just know, okay, we dispose plastic products in different bins, depending on whether it's a biohazardous material inside or not. But that's it. That's where, for scientists, it stops.
Yeah, I think you have a really good point, right? Our perspective of plastic. It starts when you order it and it enters the door to the lab. Once you put it in a bin, that's sort of where it ends for you, because then someone else is probably going to take it to the yard or take it wherever, and then it's out of your way. But it's really important to know where the plastic comes from, but also where it ends up, because it's not a happy fairy tale story when you look at what happens to the plastic after you throw it in the bin. So obviously, much of the plastic that we're using in the lab is contaminated. And a lot of it has to be incinerated because it's a biologically active material. And that means it's getting burned somewhere. And for example, in Denmark, we burn waste to produce energy and district heating. And we also clean the air, but that's not the case in all countries. So in other countries, the plastic will be incinerated in places where the waste water or the waste smoke is not cleaned properly, and toxic stuff is released to the environment, which is of course horrible. So that's the contaminated plastic waste that we have to burn. That's by law that we have to do that. And then there's all the plastic waste that isn't contaminated that we either throw in the normal bin, like the residual waste bin, or we sort it as, for example, in Denmark, we distinguish between soft and hard plastic. And of course, that's an oversimplification because there are many, many more different kinds of plastic types. Generally, we say we have 7 different types, where 1 to 6 are specific plastic types and materials, and 7 is other, so to say. So that means a lot of different kinds of mixed plastic. And the journey of the plastic depends on what type of plastic it is, but of course also how we sort it. But generally, I mean, this idea that if you sort your plastic correctly, then it will be recycled and everything is great, that's a fairy tale. That's not the truth. Because, for example, glass and aluminium, those are materials that you can endlessly recycle. So you can keep melting them and form new products, and you can melt it and you can form new products. And that's really wonderful. But that's not the case for plastics. So every time you melt plastic, the quality is simply reduced. So there is just it's not an infinite number that you can do this. You can do it sometimes, but not endlessly. So every time we recycle plastic, the quality reduces, but mostly the plastic isn't actually recycled, it's downcycled.
Can you explain to the listeners what downcycling is?
Generally, at least in Denmark, we're using the word recycling for everything, even though that's not really the word that covers the activity. So recycling in its original form, and hopefully also in its future form, is that you actually turn it into a product of similar quality where you can keep, like, you can keep recycling it somehow, right? For example, if you mix two different kinds of plastics together in a melting process, then you can no longer recycle it because you can't take them apart anymore. And that means you have not recycled it, you have downcycled it. And that's what happens to most of the plastic that we sort in the labs and in the world in general. It goes for private households as well. When we sort the plastic, small parts of it will actually be truly recycled and turned into similar products. But most of it will be turned into products of lower quality. For example, something like garden furniture or the bags that you use in the supermarket, which are in the end, those are objects that are just one step closer to the residual waste bin. It's not recycling. So maybe you're thinking, well, that's not too bad, right? Because at least most of the sorted plastic is turned into something. It may not be recycled, but at least it's downcycled. But when I say that most of it is downcycled, I don't mean most of the plastic in total. I mean, most of the plastic that we say is recycled is actually downcycled. Because the vast majority of the plastic, also the sorted plastic, is neither recycled nor downcycled.
So what you're saying is that the biohazardous waste is being incinerated, and the other waste, which could be, for example, just a tube that I've used where I put water in or a buffer, it can get recycled, but chances are probably not. And so it ends up in landfill. Is that correct?
I mean, it very much depends on the region you live in. In Denmark, for example, we're not using landfills except for ceramics and Pyrex glass, because those things can't be melted and recycled. But everything else is incinerated and becomes energy for our houses and also district heating. But for example, in the US, the residual waste will actually go to landfills, right? So if you sort the plastic, you have the chance of these things becoming recycled. But when it comes to the plastic material, odds are it's not going to be recycled. Of course, it's also not great that it ends up in landfills, but ultimately what this whole thing just illustrates is it's not as important how it exits the lab. It's more important to prevent it from entering the lab. Like, how you sort your waste is not going to make a huge difference, but if you can reduce how much plastic you're using in the lab, then you can make a huge difference.
So you mentioned now the keyword reduce. And let's talk about strategies on how to reduce plastic waste in labs. So in my daily life as a scientist, what I try to do to reduce plastic waste is that I think about the experiment in more detail. Can I reuse different tips that I used for buffer water only? Or will that contaminate my sample? If there's a risk of contamination, I don't do it. Another thing that I do is I try to find tubes that really fit the volume I'm using. For example, if I have 5 milliliters, I will go for the 5 milliliter tube rather than the 15 milliliter Falcon. Or as another example, I reuse serological pipettes when I use the same buffer. Nicolino, do you have other ideas?
I think you're really nailing it with when you say you can think about how you're doing your experiments. I think that's mostly it's the researcher himself or herself who knows how I can reduce plastic waste. I can easily say all the things that I would use 2 times or more, but I'm not doing the work that you're doing, right? And of course, you should only do it when there's no risk of contaminations, because if you in the end reuse plastics and you have to discard a whole experiment because there was contamination, then that's a waste of resources, right? Not just plastic, but all the reagents you also used. So it's, of course, it's always up to the individual researcher to say, when is it not harmful to my experiment that I'm reusing plastics, for example. For example, I used to split the cells in the same dish. I didn't always transfer cells to a new dish just because they were split. That actually reduces plastic a lot. And as you said, you can have the same serological pipette for the same buffer throughout the day. I also reused falcons, for example, for when I incubated membranes for Western blotting in falcon tubes, then I would reuse those falcons because that's anyway not sterile work. It doesn't have to be sterile. Yeah, so specifically for the non-sterile work, it's so much easier to reuse, but there are also other ways than reusing, yeah.
What I also sometimes do is, instead of putting buffers into falcon tubes, I use a glass beaker.
That's also a really good example of, you know, you have maybe a routine about using a falcon tube, but in principle, you could as well use something made out of glass. Yes, it takes a little effort to change that habit, but in many activities in the lab, you could also use glass.
I mean, the disadvantages of glass are probably that it can break, for example. It's not as tough as plastic, and one also needs to wash the glass container afterward. I've noticed whenever I order single-use plastic products for the lab, it comes with so much packaging.
I mean, one thing is, of course, that we're ordering plastic items or single-use plastic items for the labs that we are actually using in a research setting to answer whatever scientific question. And we can still reduce that. But I think it's also incredible how much plastic enters the lab that you didn't actually order, like all the packaging and the wrapping, right? And there it's really important to put pressure on the suppliers and the manufacturers. I mean, we have to let them know that we do not want to take all that packaging material from them. I mean, in the future, I hope that's never plastic, because there's no reason for packaging to be made out of that material. You can definitely find alternatives. One way you can do this, or to make your little voice count somehow, is if you have a Twitter account and you, for example, if you receive something in the lab and maybe the box is completely oversized compared to the tube or whatever is in the package. Maybe you just have a lot of plastic stuffing in it or whatever. If you feel like this is not fair, this is not an okay way to ship a product in 2021, then take a picture of it and share it on Twitter, and then tag the company that sent you that, and then use the hashtags Green Lab and Sustainable Science. If there's one thing that these companies don't like, then it's negative publicity.
Yes, I think that is a very good idea, because packaging accounts for almost 40% of all the plastics we use globally. And packaging is something we can do about because it's much easier to change packaging than changing the lab product that you're using. And obviously the main function of packaging is to protect the product, but as you were saying, there's so many examples of badly designed, oversized packaging. So there's a lot of room for improvement. And I've also read that some companies offer take-back programs for the packaging, for example, for polystyrene boxes that are then reused. However, when I looked at one specific company, I read that only roughly 30% of boxes are returned by the customers for reuse. And I'm just wondering, why is that? Is it because people are just simply not interested? Is it too much effort to return the boxes?
I think you're hitting like a really important point there, because it's not enough that the really passionate people start taking green actions in the lab. Everybody has to do a little bit. We would rather have everybody doing it imperfectly than a few people doing it perfectly. So it's not sustainable if you have to make a huge effort to use take-back programs, for example. And take-back programs can cover a lot of different things. For example, it can be the packaging materials, the styrofoam boxes, like you mentioned. It could also actually be, you know, the tip boxes or the tip wafers that actually holds the pipette tips. Those things can be, in some cases, sent back to the companies. And I think that requires some kind of infrastructure at in the lab, but also maybe at the university if you want to collect bigger portions in the yard or wherever. And then we need the manufacturers or the suppliers to make it easy for us. So they offer to come out and collect it and pick it up and all of that. And in the end, I think we should engage much more with the suppliers and manufacturers and not in an aggressive way. Maybe I sound a little aggressive when I
say
they shouldn't be sending us all this crap. But in the end, I think we have to start communicating better with the companies, because in the end, I mean, they are never going to develop products or packaging materials that they don't think there is a market for. I mean, we have to let them know that we're interested in having these things and that we're willing to pay it and or like yeah, pay for it. Otherwise, they're not going to make it. So we also have to, like, if we ever are in contact with suppliers or manufacturers, then casually ask, are you thinking about making take-back programs for any of your products or any of your packaging materials? And are you thinking about reducing how much plastic is in your packaging or in your products? And how do you actually, do you reduce how much water goes into your production? Do you use green energy? I mean, we have to ask all these questions, because if they see that many people are interested in those things, then they're also going to do it.
Yeah. Also, I mean, yeah, just in general, we need a bit more transparency. Also, what sort of plastic the single-use product I'm using in the lab is made of, because you were mentioning that often it's some sort of mix of plastics and it cannot be recycled. And obviously, we mentioned that recycling is not the solution, but just, yeah, in general, just having a bit more transparency and also having a choice as a, you know, consumer to kind of say, okay, I rather buy something that is made out of 100% of one plastic type that I know that can be maybe recycled.
And I think you're right. I mean, there are so many plastic objects, both in the lab and outside the lab, where you can't see what plastic it's composed of. That's a problem for the consumer, because when you are sorting, you don't know how to sort it because you don't know what it is. But it's also a problem after it leaves your lab or your home, because at this point in time, most of the plastic that leaves the lab or the house is hand sorted by other people. I mean, I feel like I'm sorting the plastic because I'm putting it in a separate bin, but that's not the end of it. There will actually be people either in Denmark or outside of Denmark who are by hand sorting my plastic again, because I'm only doing the rough one, right? Yeah, we are so advanced in so many ways, but when it comes to plastic recycling, we really haven't nailed it yet, because plastic is such a difficult material and there are so many different kinds and mixes and types that it's not an easy fix. And when we don't even have the pictograms, we don't even have the plastic type written on the objects, then how in the world are we going to guess what it is? I mean, you have to literally be a plastic expert to tell them apart, right? So that's also something that you can ask your suppliers and manufacturers. When will they put pictograms on their plastic products so we can see what kind of plastic it is?
Yes. So as we were saying, there are two sides to the story. On the one hand side, it's the producers, and the other side, it's us, the consumers. And it is so important to engage in a conversation, because we can provide producers with valuable feedback about their products and even maybe come up with creative ideas how to redesign their products so that they are more sustainable and they have the knowledge about manufacturing processes. And then again, for us consumers, it may seem at first a bit inconvenient to adapt to new procedures, like we were talking about experimental design or taking part in take-back programs or yeah, just changing the way we work. However, habits can be changed.
Yeah, and it's both habit and convenience. And of course, it takes an effort to change your habits, and you have to think twice before you do stuff. But in the end, you can also create new habits, right? And it does really make a difference. And even though you think, well, 5.5 million tons of plastic waste every year, my little contribution is not going to make a difference. But I mean, we all produce so much plastic waste in the labs. We're all part of that problem. And everything that one can do on your own lab bench is also making a difference. Of course it is. And you might also inspire your colleagues. I mean, in my old lab, we had this reuse table that we hung on the door where we wrote down what are the things in the lab that we can use more than once, even though the manufacturers say differently. And that's also something that inspires the other people. And we start talking about, hey, which things can be used more than once.
And this is also something that we want to achieve with this podcast. We want to engage in a public conversation. We want to inspire people. We also want to hear from the listeners and learn from the listeners. So it should be a two-side story, really. And this really brings me to the end of this podcast. And I hope we could inspire you to take actions in the lab. Recycling obviously also plays an important role, but as we have highlighted, it's not going to fix the worldwide plastic pollution. It's great when scientists can sort the plastic waste in the lab, but please don't stop there. The impact is so much higher if you would prevent the plastic from entering the lab in the first place. And here are the four top tips that you can follow to become a more sustainable scientist in the lab. Number one, reduce through reuse. Start reusing single-use items for non-sterile purposes where minor contaminations won't be a problem. Number two, we advise you to buy products in bulk instead of individually wrapped products to reduce packaging material. Number three, reload your pipette tip boxes instead of buying the whole box. And finally, number four, downsize your plastics. Sometimes there are alternatives which perform the same task with less plastic content. As I was explaining earlier, tubes between 2 and 15 milliliter exist. Why don't you look into purchasing those instead of using a 50 milliliter Falcon tube for a 5 milliliter volume?
And by taking those actions, you can already make a great difference in terms of plastic waste in the lab. But we can also guarantee you that this was not the last time that we spoke about plastic in this podcast.
Thank you so much for listening. And if you want to get in touch, please feel free to email us at podcast@avasustain.com. That is podcast@avasustain.com. We have also put this email address and other useful links in the notes below this podcast. Till next time.